Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, July 17th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abu Nima, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. Asa Wynn-Stanley is off this week. It's day 650 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, municipal engineer Asim An-Nabih will join us from Gaza City to talk about the dire impact of a fuel shortage that is one of Israel's most severe yet least visible means of collective punishment. Also, the Electronic Intifada's David Cronin will talk about why the European Union remains unconditionally committed to Israel. Later on in the program, John will cover the latest from the battles in Gaza, including the near capture of an Israeli soldier while he was demolishing houses in Khan Yunis, and the release of Israeli drone footage of a coordinated resistance ambush in Jabalia. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombarded areas across Gaza this week, killing nearly 650 Palestinians and injuring approximately 2,200 between July 9th and July 16th, according to records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza, in airstrikes, quadcopter attacks, and by live fire at the so-called aid distribution sites. On Tuesday, July 15th, Israel attacked the Beach or Shati refugee camp west of Gaza City, killing 23 people, and attacked the Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City, killing 14 people, including children, all members of the same family. One woman, Hala Arafat, was recorded live on video pleading for rescue workers to save her, her children, and the rest of her family. The Civil Defense Corps attempted to rescue those trapped under the rubble, but were prevented from doing so by the Israeli army. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for the Civil Defense, said that, quote, "We tried as hard as we could to coordinate entry so that we could reach the place before she passed away, but all coordination efforts failed. The next day, we were allowed to enter the area. Our crews entered to find the woman deceased." Basel added that they had still been receiving phone calls from people still stuck under the rubble of their homes who had managed to stay alive, but they are presumed dead. Quote, "It is reasonable to assume that the human conscience, until this moment, does not move in the face of such events taking place in the Gaza Strip," Basel stated. He said in another video report that Israel has been brutally attacking areas specifically across the northern Gaza Strip in the last 2 weeks, including in Gaza City and Jabalia. He noted that hundreds of buildings have been destroyed in this current series of attacks, while heavily populated homes are being leveled to the ground in airstrikes. He said approximately 300 Palestinians are still stuck under the rubble, with no reprieve in the intensity of the attacks. These strikes coincide with Israel's new forced evacuation orders directed at areas of northern Gaza. The United Nations Humanitarian Office said on Tuesday that Israel is ordering people to relocate to Al-Mawasi, an already overcrowded area lacking the basics for survival. The newest displacement order covers approximately 9 square kilometers, encompassing 11 neighborhoods across Gaza and North Gaza governorates, where at least 120,000 people are estimated to be residing, the UN added. Israel targeted and killed 7 children and 4 adults in a drone strike, while crowds of people attempted to retrieve clean water from a water truck on Sunday, July 13th. Water shortages in Gaza have worsened sharply in recent weeks, with fuel shortages causing desalination and sanitation facilities to close, making people dependent on collection centers where they can fill up their plastic containers, Reuters reported. That massacre was just one of several across Gaza in a 24-hour period on July 12th and 13th. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 139 bodies had been brought to hospitals within that 24-hour period. On Monday, July 14th, Israel bombed another water vehicle in central Gaza, killing the driver. Asim al-Nabi, the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, who will join us in a few minutes, wrote for the Electronic Intifada this week that, quote, during the past 21 months of Israeli aggression, 75% of Gaza City's wells were destroyed by Israel, while the remaining wells have stopped or are partially operating for limited hours that are insufficient to meet the needs of the population. He adds that, quote, in some neighborhoods, residents go days without access to clean water. Desperate families collect water from agricultural wells or polluted rainwater runoff. Children bathe in contaminated water, leaving them vulnerable to skin diseases and bacterial infections. Sewage floods streets, seeps into homes, tents, and makeshift shelter areas for displaced people, or drains into the sea. That's from Asim al-Nabi, feature A Life Without Fuel. We'll have more from Asim live with us in a few minutes. Meanwhile, the United Nations Global Protection Cluster stated that over the last 21 months of this genocide, more than 134,000 Palestinians, including more than 40,000 children, have new war-related injuries. 25% are estimated to have new disabilities requiring acute and ongoing rehabilitation, and over 35,000 people are believed to have significant hearing damage due to explosions. And an average 10 children per day lose one or both of their legs, a grim statistic that has held steady since January 2024, as this press release from Save the Children shows, that was issued just 3 months into the genocide. The United Nations has said that Gaza has the highest number of child amputees per capita than anywhere else in the world. Palestinians continue to be killed and injured trying to obtain meager amounts of food aid at so-called distribution sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, a joint U.S.-Israeli private mercenary company. Approximately 900 people have now been killed and more than 5,700 injured since the GHF began its operations under the guise of distributing aid just 7 weeks ago in late May. The Gaza government media office said that at least 21 Palestinians were killed by direct gunfire, suffocation, and a stampede at a GHF site in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza on Wednesday, July 16th. The mercenary organization told hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to go to an aid center it called SDS3, the media office said. Quote, it then proceeded to close the iron gates after gathering thousands of starving people in narrow passageways deliberately designed to suffocate them. Employees of the criminal organization and Israeli occupation soldiers sprayed pepper gas and opened direct fire on the starving people who responded to their call for aid, leading to mass suffocation and the immediate death of a large number of people at the crime scene. Dozens were injured as a result of a stampede in a closed, unexited space designed to kill, the Gaza government media office stated. Testimonies of 14 eyewitnesses who were present at the scene confirm the consistent account of the crime committed against the starving people. The government media office also previously documented the direct shooting of starving people by members of the Criminal American Organization, and visual footage was previously published proving these bloody incidents, the media office stated. Reporter Samer Al-Boji recorded family members who mourned over the bodies of their loved ones who were killed at the so-called aid site on Wednesday. Children, these are children, screams one man. What is their fault in this? To suffocate to death at the aid sites? We want to shut these aid sites down. We don't want to eat. We'd rather eat dirt. The bastards should end this and go away, another man says. There is no media to film what's happening at those sites.
يا رب يا الله يخلون اولادك حرام ويفكونه.
حرام عليك والله، حرام عليك والله، حرام عليك.
جريده
On Saturday, July 12th, at a distribution site in Rafah, video footage captured Israeli forces firing rapidly into an enormous crowd of Palestinians. Some were forced to crawl across the dirt on their bellies to avoid being shot. Footage captured by eyewitnesses also showed an American soldier firing what Euromed Human Rights Monitor says was a stun grenade on the crowd. An eyewitness told Euromed that, quote, there is a large pit just before the entrance to the aid point, where people usually hide before the gates open. Today, we were surprised to see three sand mounds facing the pit. Once the pit was packed with people, three tanks climbed onto the mounds, each carrying heavy machine guns and about 30 heavily armed soldiers and snipers. They fired sound bombs above the crowd. Anyone who tried to leave the pit was shot at directly. More than 30 Palestinians were killed in that massacre on July 12th. That was a clip from Euromed Human Rights Monitor. Mondo Weiss's Tarek Hajjaj reported on the July 12th massacre as well. He spoke to a survivor of the attack, Ahmed Haddad, who spoke from his hospital bed to recount the day's events. Quote, we go there because we want to eat, he said in a video testimony for Mondo Weiss, speaking through labored breaths while letting out painful cries between sentences. We know the danger there, but hunger is harsh. There's no other choice. The only food we can get is through the aid that they throw at us, he continued. But when we went today, the soldiers came out with their guns and the tanks came out with their machine guns. We saw the soldiers from close range aiming their weapons at our heads and sniping us like birds, as if we were worthless, as if they were amusing themselves with our blood and killing us by the dozens. Haddad says that Israeli tanks fired randomly at the crowds while soldiers watched whoever stood up and sniped them in the head. Quote, we lay on the ground, fearing the bullets and trying to save our lives, he says. But the soldiers were waiting for us, lying in ambush. Whoever stood up fell back dead. That's from Mondo Weiss on July 12th. Those who managed to obtain a box of aid from the deadly U.S.-Israeli mercenary firm are saying that the items inside the boxes are still not enough to feed hungry families. Al Jazeera's reporter Hind Khoudary said on Monday, July 14th, that, quote, the only things the GHF is distributing are flour, rice, oil, and a couple of other food items, which are not enough for Palestinian families. There are no shelter items, no medications, and no clean water. Trucks are not entering Gaza, and Palestinians are waiting every day for any news about more trucks. Whatever is coming in is not enough, she said. The United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, meanwhile stated that one in 10 children they are seeing at their clinics is suffering from malnutrition. The condition was unheard of in the enclave before October 2023, but it more than doubled in children under five between March and June amid the near-total Israeli siege, the UN said. The agency's senior emergency officer, Louise Wateridge, said on Wednesday that, quote, it's becoming more and more difficult for us to continue providing services. At least 188 UNRWA installations, over half of all of our installations in the Gaza Strip, are located within the Israeli militarized zone, under displacement orders or where these overlap, she added. Nearly 60% of essential medical supplies are now out of stock, according to the UN agency. Quote, children are dying before our eyes because we do not have the medical supplies or sustained food to treat them, UNRWA stated. And this week, Israel issued an order threatening starving Palestinians who try to fish in the sea to feed themselves. The army declared on July 12th that it had imposed restrictions along the Gaza shore and was preventing all entry into the sea. The army said that it will, quote, deal with any violation of these restrictions. Israel continues to target healthcare workers as hospitals and ambulance services remain at the brink of total collapse. The General Director of Civil Defense in the Gaza Strip announced on July 10th that all of its vehicles have had to stop providing rescue services to people in Gaza City and northern Gaza areas, as they all need repairs and are completely out of spare parts, even for basic maintenance. One fire engine is all that remains to serve the entire area of northern Gaza. In southern Gaza, the civil defense says that three out of six of their fire engines and four out of six ambulances are also completely out of service. This week, Israeli forces assassinated Dr. Ahmed Atala Hamed Kandil, one of the most prominent physicians in Gaza and an experienced general surgery consultant, in a drone strike that targeted him on his way home from working at the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City. Dr. Hussam Hamouda, a colleague of Dr. Kandil, wrote on social media that, quote, today Gaza has lost one of its medical pillars, a man who was not only a surgeon, but a living conscience who carried the burden of his nation and its people. And this week, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya's lawyer, who just visited him in Israel's notorious Ofer prison, warned that the doctor's health is deteriorating after more than 6 months in detention and enduring brutal beatings by Israeli jailers. Gaid Qasim, Dr. Abu Safiya's lawyer, stated that the pediatrician and director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, who was abducted by Israeli forces in late December, has lost more than 80 pounds in detention. Quote, Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya is not well, she stated. My last visit to him was days ago, July 9th. He lost more than 40 kilograms of his weight, more than a third. Qasim added that he was beaten by Israeli prison guards on June 24th, the day after the war with Iran ended. His cell was raided by the guards and he was brutally beaten in the ribs, she said, and suffered severe bruises on his face, head, back, and neck as well, and the beating lasted about 30 minutes. Qasim said that Dr. Abu Safiya demanded medical treatment, but his request was rejected. He suffers from an irregular heartbeat, which is not being treated, and his eyeglasses were recently broken. She added that Dr. Abu Safiya, quote, is still wearing winter clothes and is enduring starvation, torture, isolation, and destruction, remaining underground without any exposure to the sunlight. Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya and the rest of the Palestinian prisoners are not okay, she said. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers continue to escalate their attacks on Palestinians. On July 11th, 20-year-old Saif Ola Musallat was beaten to death by a mob of Jewish settlers in Sinjil near Ramallah. The settlers also shot and killed another young man, 23-year-old Mohammed Al-Shalabi, in the attack. Musallat's family said that the settlers surrounded him for 3 hours during the assault and attacked medics who were attempting to reach him. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee said the U.S., quote, must stop treating Palestinian American lives as expendable. Israeli settlers lynched 20-year-old Palestinian American Saifullah Musallat, while U.S. officials stayed silent, the advocacy group said in a statement. Saifullah was born and raised in Florida. He was visiting family for the summer in the West Bank when settlers beat him to death while he protested illegal land seizures. Musallat's cousin stated that, quote, we are devastated that our beloved Saifullah Musallat, nicknamed Saif, was brutally beaten to death on our family's land by illegal Israeli settlers who were attempting to steal it. After the mob of Israeli settlers cleared hours later, Saif's younger brother rushed to carry him to the ambulance. Saif was killed and died before reaching the hospital. Other settler pogroms were reported elsewhere in the West Bank this week. On Monday, Israeli settlers and soldiers launched several more attacks, including in Bethlehem, where settlers uprooted hundreds of olive trees in the Almania village southeast of the city, and Israeli authorities demolished a four-story residential building, Al Jazeera reported. The head of the Almania village council told Wafa news agency that a group of settlers stormed the center of Almania, set up four tents, and uprooted approximately 1,500 olive tree saplings belonging to Palestinian families. On July 11th, Israeli settlers attacked and injured a three-year-old Palestinian girl, throwing rocks at her head during a raid on Sayer village in the Hebron area. The settlers attacked residents as they gathered to celebrate a wedding. The United Nations reported that between July 8th and 14th, its humanitarian office documented at least 30 Israeli settler attacks against Palestinians that resulted in casualties, property damage, or both. These attacks led to the death of two Palestinians, one by settlers and one where it is unknown if he was killed by settlers or Israeli forces. Another 92 Palestinians were also injured during these attacks, 14 by Israeli forces and 78 by Israeli settlers. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight A Book Stall in the Rubble Nourishes Hungry Minds by Esra Abu Kamar, writing from Gaza. Amid Gaza's devastation, signs of life reappear in the most unexpected places, Esra writes. Quote, Ekra Katabek, Read Your Book, is a small bookstall that opened in late April, right in the middle of the destruction in the Nuseirat refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. Rows of Arabic and English novels, poetry, philosophy, faith, and self-help books are laid out neatly on makeshift wooden planks on the pavement, their colorful covers defying the gray dust of destruction around them. Surrounded by buildings partially or fully collapsed and debris from old and recent airstrikes, the books and their subject matter seem incongruous. With titles that speak of hope, of love, loss, and resistance, as if reflecting the emotions etched into the faces of passersby, the stall invites them to pause, read, and reconnect with a part of life that genocide has tried to erase. Books take their place amidst the ruins, Hassan al-Katrawi, a Palestinian novelist, academic, and a regular customer at the stall, wrote on his social media account. They, the Israelis, destroy us from the outside, and we build ourselves from within. The hunger for food is temporary, but the hunger for reading is eternal. Behind the modest bookstall are two young brothers from the Nuseirat camp. Salah and Abdullah Sarsour lost their home during the genocide and were displaced to a nearby school where they still shelter. They developed a passion for books at a young age, and during the now 20-month-long Israeli war of extermination in Gaza, they have not stopped reading despite all the hardships. Although accessing books is difficult, Abdullah insisted on taking long, difficult trips to northern Gaza, risking his safety and spending a lot of money on transportation to find a good read in bookshops like the iconic Samir Mansour bookshop in Gaza City. Those are excerpts from A Bookstall in the Rubble Nourishes Hungry Minds by Esra Abu Kamar, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, a teacher named Saja sets aside a few moments for a popular social media trend, giving the phone to a student who passes the phone to another. The Gaza Great Minds Foundation, which supports education initiatives in Gaza, says, quote, "One phone, countless smiles, endless love. This is what true community looks like, seeing each other's gifts and lifting them up."
Well, بعطي الجوال أكبر واحد فرفوش الصف. بعطي الجوال لأكثر واحد طويل بالصف.
بعطي الجوال لأكثر واحد ضحك بالصف.
بعطي الجوال لأكثر صحب بالصف. بعطي أنشط واحد بالصف.
That's from the Gaza Great Minds Foundation. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you so much for that. So much unbearable and heartbreaking news. And we're going to, as you said, go straight to Gaza now. With our next guest, and we're hoping we can connect and talk to him. And just a reminder, I'm Ali Abunima here with my colleague Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Only people who have lived through a genocide and felt it in their bones can truly understand what it means. The constant fear of death and loss, physical hunger, and yearning to feel safe. Reading news articles and watching videos of the aftermath of Israel's massacres might provide for a basic understanding of the situation we're enduring here in Gaza, but that is not the same as experiencing it with all five of your senses. Those words were written by Asim al-Nabi in his recent piece for the Electronic Intifada titled, Try to Imagine Living in a Genocide. Asim is an engineer, a PhD researcher, and an extraordinary writer living in Gaza City. He also serves as the spokesperson for Gaza Municipality, and we're deeply honored and grateful to welcome him once again to the Electronic Intifada live stream. Welcome, Asim. It's so good to see you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you again, Ali and Noura. It's always like a pleasure to be with you, talking about Gaza, from Gaza. And also, I would like to express my greetings and also the greetings of Gaza and Palestinian in Gaza to you, to all of you. We really respect and appreciate your efforts to spread the awareness about what is happening here in Gaza. So thank you, and thank you for everyone in your team.
It's our honor, as always.
It really is. And those words mean so much coming from you, Asim. And it pains me to say it, and I'm embarrassed to comment on it, but each time we see you, you look a little bit thinner. And that's the reality expressed in your appearance that so many people in Gaza are facing. And there's no escaping that reality right now. Now, Asim, the Electronic Intifada just published another piece you wrote called Life Without Fuel. In it, you write, of the many means of collective punishment used by Israel against Gaza, more than 2 million people, the fuel blockade is one of the most devastating and yet least understood. Asim, please help us understand how the lack of fuel impacts life and even the survival of people in Gaza right now who are already facing daily massacres and the ongoing deliberate starvation.
Well, Ali, let me start from the beginning to give like a brief about what is the real situation right now in Gaza. While I'm not sure that I can really explain and express what is really happening in the city right now and what we are enduring in terms of food insecurity, water scarcity, massive bombardments, and even the intensive damage to the infrastructure. It is unbelievable, you know, that it's a kind of suffer that people shouldn't really endure to or to live in similar circumstances. And when we talk about the fuel, fuel in Gaza now is like blood for civic services. Since Israel cut off the electricity since October 2023, from the beginning of this attack on Gaza, they stopped the electricity supplies. So now we rely 100% on a fuel to operate the remaining facilities. You know, Israel has destroyed 70% of the total water wells in Gaza. There is more than 100,000 meters in water networks, you know, the damages in water networks. 100% of the sewage pumps and plants in Gaza also got partially or totally damages. More than 200,000 of sewage network also got damages. And those numbers actually only in Gaza City, you know, while you know, double or triple of these numbers in all Gaza Strip. And 85% of the heavy vehicles also have been destroyed, you know, and in the past 22 months. So we have limited resources right now. And there is a huge need for the civic and for these basic services. And when we talk about basic services, it's like, you know, water, solid waste management, sewage treatment, and open roads, which is closed by because of the rubbles and the damages to facilities and buildings in the city. And to do that, we need fuel. We need fuel to pump water from the remaining wells. You know, we need fuel to treat the sewage. We need, and now we are not treating that. We need fuel just to pump it to the sea. Otherwise, it will be like a sewage flooding around the city, and that's what we are seeing daily among the city. We can see sewage flooding to tents, to homes, to even to the displacement areas, to schools, to everywhere. So, as an engineer at the municipality of Gaza and as the spokesperson of Gaza, I know fuel is very essential. It's a life-saving need right now, because without the fuel, water can't be pumped, sewage can't be treated, solid waste. Well, now it's already accumulated in every street corner in the city. We are talking about 250,000 ton of solid waste now are accumulated in the city, in Gaza City itself. So, and to be honest, I don't know why they don't allow sufficient amount of fuel just to alleviate the suffering of people. We are not talking about, you know, rebuilding the city, start the reconstruction steps. No, we just need to operate some water wells, some sewage plants and the stations. We need to operate some heavy vehicles to collect the solid waste from the city. We called the NGOs. We called for a real action. We called the UN. We called everyone around the world. You know that. Please let us do our work. We need to do our work. We have great engineers. We have great workers. And we are work tersely just to serve our people who are really, you know, they are living under a very difficult circumstances. They are facing many difficulties every day. As the sun rises, they start to think what to eat, how to feed their kids, how to get to drinking water. So at least we need to provide them some water. We need to collect the solid waste from around their houses and their tents. So fuel is essential right now to alleviate the people's suffering. Without a fuel, the municipalities in Gaza Strip won't be able to do and to provide the minimum needs, you know, that people are asking for now. We tried our best. We tried to do some, initial maintenance for some wells. We used our manual and sometimes we use like an old ways and old equipment to maintain these equipments and to maintain these wells and some stations in the city. But just to sum up, it's a massive and a huge damages in the city, in all infrastructure and civic facilities. The municipality lost the majority of its capacity. We have limited resources now. We don't have sufficient amount of fuel. So the result is what we are seeing now, right now. It's an environmental and healthy crisis. People are getting a few amount of water. And in general, when we talk about solid waste accumulating in the city, and when we talk about water scarcity, and we talk about sewage flooding, so that lead to a healthy crisis. And this is what already the Ministry of Health, they talk about skin conditions, stomach conditions, especially among the children. So again, we need to send and to convey our message again through AI and to everyone that please do something. We need just sufficient amount of fuel to operate the civic facilities right now. And if we have time just to go deeply in this situation. Like, this is regarding the civic facilities, okay? But what about the personal and the individual needs? Do you know how people are cooking right now in the city? There is no gas, there is no fuel, there is no electricity. So they start to burn their box, their clothes, their furniture, the wood, the trees, the sponges, the fabrics. You know, it's like that's lead to environmental crisis. I mean, maybe they will move because of the environment. It's like even the individuals are really struggling because there is a lack of fuel. And yeah, we need to mention about the collapsing of transportation system, collapsing of a food supplies system, the collapsing of communication system. So fuel is affecting actually every single service that we need in our normal life, and especially in a genocide time.
Awesome. It's just, it's so overwhelming. You know, as you say, people are, you know, as soon as they wake up, it's this struggle just for basic needs and necessities. In your art, in the art, one of the articles that you wrote for us recently, Try to Imagine Living in a Genocide, you write about a suggestion you made to your wife regarding your children who have been living outside Gaza since before the genocide. Tell us what that suggestion is and why you made it.
Yes, I was thinking, and my family were outside of the city before the beginning of the war. And now it's almost it's already 2 years since I didn't meet them yet. I really miss my wife Islam, my son Iyad, and my daughter Furat. I really miss her, especially Furat. But also I want them to know that their father and their wider family and the people in Gaza are really struggling, you know. And that's why my wife and I try to explain to them what is happening. But recently I suggested here that, what about you let them, the two kids, to use only limited amount of water to understand what is water scarcity means. So, because I want them to really understand, observe what is water scarcity, you know, because I can't tell you numbers and statistics, data, numbers, and the statements will give you a basic understanding, but it won't give you a deep understanding about what is the big terms means, water scarcity, food insecurity, starvation. But do you really understand what that means? And it's not a call for guilt, you know. I love my kids. I want them to enjoy their life, you know. I'm not blaming them for because they are not here in Gaza, you know. But I believe imagination could lead to a real understanding. And real understanding would lead to a bold actions. And bold actions will, of course, lead to effective results. And that's what we need. Because as someone live in the city, 2 years, almost 2 years of genocide, I want that to be stopped. You know, I want an end for the genocide. So I thought every day, I'm thinking every day that what people, what my friends around the world should do, you know, because I also wrote in EI an article that don't ask me what should we do or what should people do, okay? Because it's your duty to figure out what to do, okay? So this is another step, you know, that you need to understand. You need to really understand, because you can just watch videos and check reels, but you won't understand what is the starvation means, and you can't feed your kids and your children losing weight, crying from hunger. So you need to imagine what that. And just let me do something. Imagine this. There is a man in Gaza today, wake up in the early morning, had no breakfast, walked to his work. He's working for 650 days right now with no salary and no day off, in a high risk working area. Then he got plain rice for his lunch. Then he needs to walk from a place to another place where his family yesterday just evacuated from a displacement area to another displacement area, you know, because there is an evacuation order from the Israelis. Then he came back again to a place with no electricity. His phone battery is going to die, and he has a small battery, so he ran his internet connection, doing an interview, and of course he won't have a dinner tonight. This is me, okay? And I consider myself lucky because I can get a daily meal. I can charge my phone and my laptop once a day. I have access to the internet. At least my family, yes, they split apart into two groups yesterday. So I need, and my father and some of my family members in a place, and my mother with some other family members in another place. But at least we have places to go. We know, you know, I know where are they. So I consider myself lucky. So imagine Imagine that. Imagine this is just a flash to one day. Yesterday, I survived, you know, a deadly strike. It was like only 100 meters away from me. So it's like, again, I need to repeat it. It's not a call for guilt. I knew my message was for my for our supporters and our friends around the world that please do something from a deeper understanding, you know? So, I mean, I wish that I explained myself because a lot of my friends sent me that it was great, but in the beginning I thought that, it's, oh no, I don't want people to feel bad about themselves. The main objective of the article is to encourage people to do something.
Yeah.
Not
you, and you expressed that very clearly in the article, and you gave the examples of other solidarity actions that people have taken, including fasts and hunger strikes, in order to not to experience what you're experiencing, because that's impossible, but to just have some connection between their body experiencing something that can help them to understand in a way that reading statistics can't. I thought it was a really beautiful piece and a beautiful way to seek that deeper understanding and to continue to encourage people, which is what we're always trying to do, to take action and visible action, to express solidarity, to express their support for people in Gaza, to express their rejection of the normalization of this genocide. That is so important now, and even more so now. We'll talk about that later as well. Awesome. I want to point to this photo that you posted on social media a week ago, of a date, one date next to a ruler. What is this date here? Tell us about this.
It's just a date, you know, Ali. It's just a date, a 4-centimeter date. But I kept it for 6 months, and I used to say myself that for the darkest days, you know, and the darkest days are here right now. And I love dates. Arabs like dates, and I love dates, you know, and my mother loves dates too. So after 6 months, when I get it, I decided to give it to my mother. The next day, she told me that she passed it to my daughter, to my sister Nisma. Nisma was born in 2008, so she survived 2008, 2012, 2014, 2019, 2021, and she's a survivor so far. She is 17 years now. She's studying for her secondary school without teachers, without electricity, without internet, just some old books. And I believe she is genius, you know. So my mother decided to pass that date to Nisma because she believes that she needs it. She needs some, you know, some sugar, some snacks, you know, during her study. Then Nisma decided to pass that date to my nephew, Mu'min. This boy is 2 years old, and he was born just 2 months before the war, and he lost his father, Mu'taz Rajab, a 37-year-old gentleman, postgraduate economist and researcher. So this boy didn't know what a date mean, you know? So Nisma gave it to Mu'min. Then I thought about, like, you know, it's just a date. We shouldn't take these decisions, you know, just to eat a date. And then, and that's where I start to think about, we love each other. We really love each other, you know. And there is a lot of good in the city, among the people. Maybe the war might lead, you know, to some bad actions from some people, which is I really understand. You know, it's a genocide. We can't blame people for some actions. But overall, I like to see good things in the people, and that's what I really notice. You know, that people are really understand each other and they support each other. And this date is like a symbol of love. And I just took that picture. I don't know how I realized that I wanted to measure the length of that date, you know, but then, but it's for me very precious, because I kept it for 6 months, give it to my mother passed it to my sister gave it to my nephew. And it's only one event happened in Gaza, but every day we saw examples that Palestinians deserve to live. Palestinians deserve to live in peace. The ones to do good for themselves, for their city, for their homeland, and even for the world civilization. So give us that a chance, you know? Maybe some people will say it's just a date. Yes, it is just a date, but there is a lot of meaning in this date. I hope our supporters and our, you know, friends around the world that can catch my idea in this post.
Mm. It's extraordinary, awesome, that nobody wants to eat the last date. Nobody wants to deprive someone else of it. Do you think Nesma will? Am I allowed to ask if Nesma will eat it? I know everyone wants her to eat it, maybe because she's the, I don't know if she's the youngest, but I know people give everything for those they love.
Of course. Nesma is my youngest sister, right? And we believe she is a genius girl and a war survivor, a wars survivor, you know. She can speak three languages. I don't know if there is anyone can beat her in mathematics and physics. She wants to be a doctor to help her people. I know she will do it. I believe that she will survive this genocide. She's a survivor. She survived, you know, a 17 years without electricity, without, you know, with nothing. But also I feel sad about her. Like a young girl in her age should go to her school, enjoy, you know, the trip to the school with her friends, going out, maybe travel abroad, getting some experiences. Not a genocide, of course. But also I believe that this sacrifice and these kind of sacrifices would lead to better results. I wish that, you know, because we paid a precious price just to get our freedom and our self-determination. And we believe that our starvation, our blood is might lead the people and the world leaders to take some decisions and actions to change the situation here in Palestine. We are enduring and struggling for 78 years, actually for a century, you know, not, you know, it's not only 78 years. And I wish Nisma will live in a better, you know, time. She will, I wish she can study medicine as she wants and to eat dates without count them. And the need to pass her only date to her nephew. That's my hope.
I think that's all of our hope for you and your family and everyone in Gaza who deserves the world. Assam, how are you feeling now? I mean, this genocide has lasted for 21 months. How, what keeps you going? And what can you say about your own personal internal universe right now?
Look, it's okay. I feel that I might be killed in any moment. This is that feeling is, you know, chasing me in the past few months, and I can't kick it, you know, out of my mindset and my thoughts. And obviously everyone in Gaza is feeling the same, that I might be the next victim. I me or one of my family and my friends might be the next victim, the next martyr. But this is not the scariest emotions, you know. What is the scariest part is, the scariest part is that you know, and I know, and everyone knows that there is an army and a government in the 21st century in a free world that could kill any civilian for nothing, for no reason. This is the scariest part, that we are living in a time where killing children is fine. You know, can you imagine that? While starvation for civilians is okay. Like, where the hell are we living? You know, that make me feel bad. You know, it's a harmful feeling, a harsh feeling to everyone. I just imagine what does that mean to someone to live in this world, that he might be killed any time. And I know, you know, Israel doesn't need a reason to kill someone or any justification to kill any Palestinians. You know, they killed us for years, for decades now. So, but also I feel optimistic because we are a freedom seekers, you know, we are a freedom seekers. We tried our best. We really tried our best. And I always remind myself about what my close Rifat, my close friend Rifat, my teacher, Dr. Rifat, he once said, if I must die, let it bring hope. I also say the same, but also I add, if I must die, let it bring hope. If I must die, let it bring resistance. If I must die, let it bring revolution. If I must die, let it bring freedom, justice, liberation, peace. Because I'm not going to die for nothing, you know. My people are not dying for nothing. Yes, I feel sad about myself. I feel sad about my people, about my family, but also I feel sad about the people, you know? if there's cancer in a body, you have to stop it or you will be die. So the world has to stop this cancer before it kill everyone, you know? I can't stop myself think about that, you know? It's a harmful feeling, actually, you know, that you know that you will lose your life in a second and just strike. Maybe the AI will decide to kill you or not. So when you ask me about my feeling, that's my feeling, that I know that I might be the next victim, but at the same time, I still stick to my freedom. I still call for my freedom, and that's our main objective right now, to stand tall in front of Israel and to say no to them loudly and loud as much as we can, because there is no other choice. Unfortunately, there is no other choice.
Awesome. It's difficult to listen to you. And I don't think there are many words I can offer you that that lessen the reality and the truth of the words you've spoken. Or I don't want to say lessen them, but lighten the weight. The only thing I can say is that we've heard what you've said, and you from Gaza have renewed our commitment and our strength and our promise not to abandon people in Gaza in any way, to continue to speak out from every platform we have, to call for an end to this genocide, to demand an end to this genocide, to hold those who are accountable, who are responsible for this genocide. That this is a struggle. You remind us that this isn't a struggle for water or food or fuel or medicine. Those things are vital to human life. But this is a struggle for liberation, for the life of a country, the life of a people who've been denied it for so long. And that struggle cannot be killed, because Israel and its allies have tried everything possible to destroy that struggle and destroy that will for liberation, for freedom, for a life of dignity. And they have failed. And no matter how many people they kill, they will never kill that. And I will just say, Asim, that we pray for you. We love you.
I love you too.
We hear you.
I recently, don't be afraid, because I have recently renewed my soul's quota, you know, because they used to tell me that I am like a cat with seven souls. So I just renewed my soul's quota now. So don't worry, I will be fine, inshallah.
Inshallah. we pray for you, and We pray for you and all the people to be safe and for this to end, and that we always see you well and happy. And sure. We pray for Nesma and for her future and the future of all the young people and children of Gaza. You have never given up on them.
Of course.
You've never given up on them. And so we can't either. God bless you and protect you. Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Asim. Much love. It's very, he's such a beautiful man, and so honest, and it's so, you know, that's what Israel is trying to break, is the community, is the strength of the love between a family, and their land. I mean, they are trying to break Palestinians in every single way, and Palestinians keep refusing, and it's driving the Zionists insane. I want Asim and his family to be protected, just as we want everyone we know and we love and everyone we don't know in Gaza to be protected. It's all, it all seems very, very bleak and very, you know, like we're just teetering off a precipice every day. And Asim is there still with so much integrity and belief in his community and in his people and liberation struggle.
He expresses it in just an extraordinary way. He's an extraordinarily extraordinary gifted writer and communicator, but he expresses something that is strong in practically everyone in Gaza.
Yeah.
And that hope, that determination to live, to get up every day and survive, and not just to survive, but to believe in a future where the children of Gaza who are being starved and murdered actually grow up to be doctors, and to fulfill all their dreams and their potential. They haven't given up on that, and so nor can we. And this is the thing. This is our duty to take away from what Asim said, is go out and shout about it. Go out and shout about Gaza. Let people see you. Don't let the politicians hide.
That's right. And don't collapse into despair.
Hard. It's painful.
Of course.
But that should spur us to get up every day and to do what we can. And so many people are doing that. And I just want to say thank you and keep doing it. And you're not alone. You're not alone. This is not normal. This can't be normalized. It's like I always say, it's like trying to live in a house that's on fire. You can't just say, oh, well, it's fine, I'll get used to it. You won't get used to it. We can't get used to this. And so we can't let it break us either.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you, Ali. Coming up in a few minutes, of course, we'll have John, but we have a special guest that is going to join us. Just a reminder, you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. On Tuesday, the European Union decided not to suspend its association agreement with Israel. Agnès Callamard, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, accused Brussels of a, quote, cruel and unlawful betrayal of the European Union's supposed commitment to international law, of its own rules, and of the human rights of Palestinians. Callamard added European leaders had the opportunity to take a principled stand against Israel's crimes, but instead gave it a green light to continue its genocide in Gaza, its unlawful occupation of the whole occupied Palestinian territory, and its system of apartheid against Palestinians. Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar hailed the inaction by EU member states as a, quote, diplomatic victory for Tel Aviv. The EU-Israel Association Agreement provides Israel with enormous trade benefits and other privileges, but its implementation is supposed to hinge on Israel's respect for human rights. Last month, the EU completed a long-awaited review of the agreement and concluded that Israel is in violation of the Human Rights Clause. Tuesday's meeting of the EU Foreign Affairs Council would have been the opportunity to suspend the agreement and impose sanctions. But instead, Kaya Kallas, the EU's foreign minister, said that Brussels has entered into a voluntary agreement with Israel in which Israel, which is openly, deliberately starving Palestinians in Gaza, agreed to allow more humanitarian aid in. It's an agreement that comes with no enforcement mechanism whatsoever. The next opportunity for the EU to take any concrete action would be at its Foreign Affairs Council meeting in October, In the 3 months until then, thousands more Palestinians are certain to be murdered by Israel. Joining us now to discuss these developments is our very own colleague, Electronic Intifada Associate Editor David Cronin. He's an expert on EU-Israel relations. His most recent article is called "German Aristocrats Backed Hitler, Now They Support Israel." It focuses on two prominent EU officials, and we'll talk about him. We'll talk to him about that as well. Welcome to the live stream, Dave.
Thanks very much, Nora.
So prior to Tuesday's EU Foreign Affairs Council meeting, it was reported that Kaja Kallas, the EU's foreign minister, was set to offer member states 10 possible measures to hold Israel accountable. The options included suspending the whole association agreement, banning trade with settlements, ending visa-free travel to the EU for Israelis, and denying Israel access to other EU benefits. Were you surprised that in the end the EU decided to do absolutely nothing? And what do you think happened? Who's blocking the sanctions here? Or what? What is blocking the sanctions?
I'll deal with the first question first, if that's okay, Nora. Yeah. To be perfectly honest with you, I wasn't in the least bit surprised. The European Union has been pretty consistent, appallingly consistent throughout this genocide. In October 2023, when the genocide was already underway, the European Union's governments, all 27 of them, collectively issued a statement presenting Israel's genocidal war as defensive. Since then, the European Union has continued pretty much on a business as usual way in terms of its relations with Israel. One document drawn up by European Union officials earlier this year even celebrated what it called the richness and vitality of the relations between the European Union and Israel. During the month of May, there was admittedly some ground for hope. 17 of the EU's 27 governments decided then to request a review of the association agreement that you mentioned, the main contractual basis of relations between the European Union and Israel. That review concluded in very timid language that there were indications that Israel was breaching the agreement. I should say that Article 2 of that agreement makes it abundantly clear that all relations between the European Union and Israel are based on, or should be based on, respect for fundamental human rights. That was in May. Since then, a couple of things have happened. Israel, first of all, attacked Iran, and the European Union collectively sided with Israel in that attack, despite how, or perhaps because of how, it involved the crime of aggression, a very serious crime that has been recognized since the time of the Nuremberg trials following the Second World War. More recently, as you mentioned, just last week, Kaja Kallas, being the European Union's foreign policy chief, announced that she had reached an agreement with Israel on increasing the amount of humanitarian aid into Gaza. And this was presented as a major breakthrough. The details of this agreement have not been actually published, so we don't know exactly how much aid is involved. But this kind of did change the dynamic, and it did allow Israel to buy very valuable time and to continue its genocide without any fear of being held accountable by the European Union. You asked who's blocking this? Perhaps it's best to focus on the biggest obstacle to any action by the European Union. The name of that obstacle is Germany. Germany, of course, is the most populous country in the European Union and the most powerful economically in the European Union. Of course, it's a country where a Holocaust, well, it's a country that carried out a Holocaust in the last century and is now actively supporting a Holocaust against the Palestinian people to try and atone for that horrible Holocaust in the 20th century. It is now fully supporting a Holocaust against the Palestinian people in the 21st. We should be very clear about this. The two key enablers of the Gaza genocide are the United States and Germany. 99% of all weapons sales to Israel before the genocide got underway came from the United States and Germany. Germany has continued selling weapons to Israel during the genocide. The relatively new chancellor in Berlin, Friedrich Merz, not so long ago celebrated the friendship between Germany and Israel as a great treasure. This is how Germany regards its relations with Israel. Germany, when Angela Merkel was the chancellor, actually declared that defending Israel is Staatsraison. That's normally translated as reason of state or a fundamental duty for Germany. Germany is absolutely determined, it appears, to prevent any collective European Union action against Israel.
Yeah. Thank you, David. In your latest article, you write that, quote, rather than sticking to her actual job as the European Union's coordinator for combating anti-Semitism, Katharina von Schnürbein is defending the Holocaust which Israel is inflicting in Gaza. And last week, the EU Observer, which is a publication that focuses on what happens in Brussels, EU Observer published some revelations about von Schnürbein's activities. Now, as a result of those revelations, members of the European Parliament are calling on von Schnürbein to resign. What did EU Observer reveal? And I know that you've reported for the Electronic Intifada for many years very closely on Katharina von Schnürbein, often digging things up with freedom of information requests that she doesn't want made public. But tell us what the EU Observer found out that we didn't know. And do you think she played a role? You've mentioned the overwhelming role of Germany, but do you think she might have played a role in staving off sanctions for Israel at this point?
Sure. Katharina von Schnürbein is a Bavarian aristocrat who was appointed to be the European Union's coordinator for combating anti-Semitism in December 2015. I managed to get hold of the job description, her contract. There's not one mention of Israel in that document. Her job is supposed to be restricted to defending Jews within Europe from bigotry and hostility. However, she has, throughout the decade, in which she has held her post, acted essentially as an agent for Israel. I'm not alleging that she's being paid by Israel, but she is nonetheless fighting Israel's corner and giving every indication that she is essentially
an agent
for Israel
it's
in the Brussels bureaucracy.
Yes, yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but it's worse because she is acting as an agent for Israel, and Israel doesn't have to pay for it. EU taxpayers are paying for it.
Sure. Yep. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
The excellent article that you mentioned, published by the EU Observer websites, showed it was based on a trip that Katharina von Schoenbein undertook quite recently to Tel Aviv, during which she met senior figures in the Israeli government, including the aforementioned Gideon Saar, the Israeli foreign minister, if I'm not mistaken. But the EU Observer got hold of a report of a meeting that Katharina von Schoenbein held with various European diplomats, and in that meeting, she made quite extraordinary claims. These included her allegation that there are new forms of anti-Semitism, such as what she described as ambient anti-Semitism. The example that she gave of ambient anti-Semitism was a bake sale organized by some of her colleagues in the Brussels bureaucracy to raise money for a Gaza appeal by the Irish Red Cross. Somehow this altruistic charity event was an example of ambient anti-Semitism in the mind of Katharina von Schoenbein. The European Union officially wants to encourage innovation, and perhaps Katharina von Schoenbein has gone beyond innovation here by actually imagining something that doesn't really exist at all. But we have to say that this is not uncharacteristic of Katharina von Schoenbein. She has been making fake allegations of anti-Semitism for many years. She has been alleging that the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is motivated by hostility to Jews. Just recently, she also, I should add, she also alleged that the concerns raised by 17 European Union governments, the 17 European Union governments who requested a review of relations with Israel, those concerns were not based on facts, but they were based on, according to her, on rumors about Jews. Katharina von Schoenbein just recently has been trying to ban or restrict use of such slogans as the very famous slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." She argues that this is a call for annihilation of the people living in the current state of Israel, even though it's clearly the opposite. It's actually a clear call for justice and equality throughout the historic land of Palestine. So, yes, clearly, as I mentioned, Katharina von Schoenbein has quite a restricted mandate. She's not supposed to deal with questions relating to the Middle East at all, and has actually admitted herself that she doesn't have any mandate to deal. On occasion, she's admitted that she doesn't have any mandate at all to deal with the Middle East. Yet clearly, in this case, she has been meddling in foreign policy discussion, something that she has no responsibility for. As you mentioned, Ali, some members, I think it was 25 or 26 members of the European Parliament, have called for her to resign. Unfortunately, Katharina von Schwerbein enjoys quite high-level support in the Brussels bureaucracy. It would appear that she is supported from the top. Her fellow German aristocrat, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, appears to be a supporter of Katharina von Schnurbein and committed to the same agenda of weaponizing anti-Semitism. A little notice move by Ursula von der Leyen when she took up her second term as the European Commission president was to actually poach Katharina von Schnurbein. By that I mean Katharina von Schnurbein used to work in the Justice Department of the European Commission, but she now actually works in the what's called the Secretariat General, the core administration of the Brussels bureaucracy, which is headed politically and overseen politically by Ursula von der Leyen herself. So Ursula von der Leyen is now the direct boss of Katharina von Schnurbein, which appears to indicate that she's fully on board with this agenda of weaponizing anti-Semitism and smearing the Palestine solidarity movement.
Yeah, and of course, the citizens of Europe have absolutely no say or control over any of this, no accountability. She's been in that role for 10 years and doesn't come up for review. There's no vote on her staying in that role. Not even the European Parliament has a say in it. So it really just shows how undemocratic the EU is. And of course, as you mentioned, she's played a role in a direct role meddling on behalf of Israel, openly and behind closed doors. And recently, she also disseminated just a week or so ago, the revived October 7th rape hoax that Asa Winstanley and I debunked on last week's show. So she's also actively spreading atrocity propaganda that aids and abets and justifies or seeks to justify Israel's genocide. So she is doing the very things the two Palestinians that she claims Jews need protection from: incitement, spewing racial and ethnic and genocidal hatred, and all of this paid for by the European Union.
Absolutely. I just add that she's not alone in supporting and abetting genocide. Kaya Kallas, who was mentioned earlier, the European Union's foreign policy chief, said earlier this week that the aim of the European Union is not to punish Israel. Now, we have to bear in mind, Ali, that under international law, under the United Nations Genocide Convention, there is an obligation on governments and governmental bodies around the world to punish the crime of genocide, the crime of crimes, as it's often described. Article 1 of that convention, so the very beginning, pretty much the very beginning of that convention, actually says that governments around the world have an obligation to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. So when Kaya Kallas is saying that the aim is not to punish Israel, what she's really doing is allowing a genocide to continue and abetting the crime of genocide. And she should, along with other figures such as Katharina von Schnurbein and Ursula von der Leyen, who told Benjamin Netanyahu in October 2023 that he could count on the European Union support. These figures are abetting a genocide and they should be held accountable for doing so.
And I'll just note too that Kaya Kallas, who you just mentioned, who said the aim is not to punish Israel, vocally, sometimes several times a day, talks about how important it is to punish Russia. So it's not that she's against...
How many sanctions packages has the EU
I think there are issued? 18. They've passed 18 sanctions packages against Russia. So she's not against punishment of countries in general. She's not in favor of dialogue and voluntary agreements with perpetrators of international crimes or countries she accuses of that. In general, it's only Israel that she wants to protect from punishment and accountability. I think we have time for one more quick question, Nora.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, you not only look at, you know, the goings on of what's happening at the highest levels of the EU leadership bodies, but you also have a very keen eye tuned to what civil society, you know, which is being ruled by these genocidal maniacs, is doing to pressure their governments. What can you say about kind of popular pressure on the EU by, you know, grassroots popular movements in places like Ireland and Spain, for example?
Yeah, Ireland, Spain, and Slovenia, I think, were the first countries in the European Union to actually use the word genocide. Okay, they dragged their heels, but they eventually, in the last few months, have described the situation in Gaza as a genocide. And that obviously, now that they have acknowledged that genocide is going on, there's an onus on them to act. Any action that they have taken has, of course, been the result of popular pressure. In Ireland, my own country, the government is finally doing something. It is finally bringing forward legislation to ban goods from Israel's settlements in the occupied West Bank and the Golan Heights of Syria. Excuse me. This is something that the Irish government has dragged its heels on doing. An earlier and actually better, stronger version of this legislation was actually approved by both houses in the Irish Parliament some time ago, but the government decided to block its implementation using the spurious argument that their hands were tied by the European Union. I'm happy to see that the Irish government, although they have diluted this legislation, they do seem to be committed to introducing a ban on goods from Israel's settlements. And they do seem to be standing up to such pressure as the statement issued by a man called Mike Huckabee this week, Mike Huckabee being the current United States ambassador to Israel. Mike Huckabee alleged that the Irish have fallen into a vat of Guinness by introducing this legislation and express hope that the Irish will sober up. Needless to say, that is quite a racist stereotype of the Irish. I personally haven't had a drink in over 20 years now. For the information of Mr. Huckabee, if he is listening. Anyway, despite the fact that I'm a proud Irish man, despite the fact that I'm relieved that the Irish government is finally doing something, I'm not prepared to praise the Irish government in any way. They are still using a similar excuse to avoid taking other forms of action against Israel. The Irish Central Bank in Dublin hosts the sale of Israeli bonds throughout the European Union. These bonds used to be sold by Britain, but because of Brexit, because Britain has decided to leave the European Union, it has moved the sale of these bonds. Israel has moved the sale of these bonds from London to Dublin, and there's been a lot of pressure from the Palestine Solidarity Movement to end the sale of these bonds, which is to say that Israel itself has actually admitted it is that these bonds are helping to finance its war effort against Gaza. So in other words, these bonds are actually being sold in Dublin and are helping to finance a genocide which the Irish government disapproves of. The Irish government is claiming that its legal advice says that it is obligated under European Union law to allow the sale of these bonds to continue. It has not published the legal advice in question, so we don't know exactly what the advice entails. But I don't trust the Irish government anyway. I think it's quite disgraceful that the Irish government, I think it's obviously hypocritical, it's flagrantly hypocritical that the Irish government, on the one hand, is prepared, after dragging its heels, to eventually call Israel's actions in Gaza a genocide, yet is also prepared to allow the sale of bonds which are financing this genocide. The Irish government needs to act right now and end this disgraceful contribution it is making to a genocide. And hopefully others will follow suit.
Yeah, no kidding.
If Ireland takes action.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's it. All it could take is one state to kind of get the domino effect rolling. Well, thank you so much, Dave. That is David Cronin. He is our colleague, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. Your latest news post is called "German Aristocrats Backed Hitler, Now They Support Israel." And that is, of course, up right now on electronicintifada.net. David, thank you so much for all that you do. And it's always, always great to have you in front of the camera this time on the live stream. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, David.
God.
David,
the barbarity of EU.
Yeah, politics. But David was there before most people. I mean, he wrote a book about EU-Israel relations, yeah. Europe's alliance with Israel, which was published in 2010. And since then, he has been on this beat, and he is expert at navigating the EU's rules, which are designed to thwart like many countries or many entities, they have freedom of information legally, but then the bureaucrats have all these ways of trying to prevent you from getting information. He has a very, very skilled at getting that information out. Some of it very embarrassing to the EU, but that's what we do at the Electronic Intifada. We try the best if we can, to hold these powerful institutions accountable. And nobody does that better than David.
That's right. Well, thanks so much. Let's bring John on for the Resistance Report. Hey, John.
Hi, guys. Great show.
Yeah, thanks.
Heartbreaking and amazing to hear. Awesome.
Yeah.
Every time. Story, when I first saw it, yeah. Just was like a body blow.
Yeah. Yeah,
and just so important to know that people are still living in northern Gaza, in Gaza City. It's still a city.
And doing work every day. I don't know. He didn't really underscore that too much, but he's working hard every day to keep the municipality going with his colleagues, and it's really heroic work that
Basic essential tools and you know, infrastructure completely gone.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was targeted. Targeted in the early days of the war, and has been ever since. And that's the goal.
Unbelievable. Well, there is, of course, a lot of resistance that continues to happen in northern Gaza. John, take it away.
All right, let's do it. All right, you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report for day 650. I am reporting this on July 17th. As always, we're going to start with the maps to get our grounding here. This first map is the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, showing 85% of Gaza in a shoot-to-kill zone, including the entire governorate of Rafah in the south that you can see, and much of Khan Yunis as well. You can see that white part along the beach is Mawasi, where daily massacres in the tent camps happen. There's no infrastructure in Mawasi. Tents are lined up row upon row. And so when the fires start in those camps, they spread from tent to tent. And there's no proper roads. There's no proper fire services. And it's an absolute nightmare that Israel keeps attacking. And I'll say it every time we do this show, that the battle spaces in Gaza are not the places that Israel is carrying out the massacres. The battle spaces have been cleared of civilians, and the resistance is fighting in areas cleared of civilians. The massacres that Nora reports on so well at the top of every show, those are happening in areas separate from the battlefield. And Israel this week told us on one day there was 150 airstrikes in Gaza. The next day there was 125. There was 250 over the weekend in the 2 days, 400 strikes in 72 hours. They're killing 100 people a day. They also expanded their attacks in Syria. More than 260 targets in Syria hit in the last 48 hours or so. Interesting note on Rafah this week, the Israeli state broadcaster, military correspondent, reported through the military censor that the Israeli military recently rescued a group of Palestinian collaborators who were trapped under a collapsed building in Gaza, a mission that they were sent on by the IDF. So that's Yasser Abu Shabab's gang that numbers a few hundred gang members, and they are living in Rafah. Nobody else, no other Palestinians are living in Rafah. And that medevac was carried out by Israel's Unit 669, their tactical unit for special rescue. Those are the medevac helicopters that we watch on the Resistance Report constantly. They're now using them for their collaborators. If we look at the next map, this is the Israeli battle space map that they show. You can see the 143rd Division is destroying in Rafah. That's at the bottom left of your map. That dotted line is the Moreg corridor that was cut through. I reported on that as it was happening in April. Predominantly, the Operation Gideon's Chariots began May 19th. And the Palestinian resistance operation to match that is called the Stones of David operation. But you can see the difference in the maps, the Israeli military maps versus the shoot-to-kill zone. They do not control these areas that are the shoot-to-kill zones. And this map is, again, they keep publishing this map. It's somewhat surprising to me because these are I wouldn't normally show these Israeli maps, but they're accurate about where their military is operating and how much of Gaza is actually not under their control. But you can see devastating areas like in the north on the far right of the map, down in the south, in the northeast, Beit Hanun has been virtually completely wiped out, as is Beit Lahia across from it. And of course, Rafah is the same. This week, the 401st Armored Brigade commander spoke about a shortage of troops, because the Israeli map here shows five divisions operating in Gaza, but they're not operating with a full complement. When five divisions were in Gaza at the beginning of the war, they had a full complement, four to five brigades in each division. That is not happening at this point. They are short of soldiers, Army Radio pointed out this week, after the death of three soldiers from the 401st Armored Brigade. Army Radio said, where will the Armored Brigade commander get the four fighters who were supposed to be replaced by a tank in Jabalia by now? From outer space? Our elected representatives in the Knesset have the solutions. Until then, the tank in Jabalia will stand orphaned. He's talking about the ultra-Orthodox dodging the draft to keep Netanyahu's government together. Army Radio also reported from the head of the international of the Institute for National Security Studies, which is Israel's leading arm's length think tank, Major General Tamir Heyman, who attacked the government yesterday by saying, I am a tanker, and so I know the biggest nightmare for tankers is to get stuck inside a burning tank without being able to get out. And yesterday, while a tank was burning, a parallel world was operating. How to create a deal to exempt people from service so that they never reach this situation. So two leading military figures there speaking out, and again, Army Radio saying the tank in Jabalia will stand orphaned. And that is part of the reason why Israel's a shortage of troops. We know some estimates of their number of casualties, although those have been hidden, but we're talking about numbers in the thousands, in the many thousands. And if you count draft reservists who didn't come back from their draft orders, you're in the tens of thousands. So Israel's strung at their max fighting this war, and the resistance keeps them in that position. The next map is just another way to look at the destruction in Gaza. And you can see this is a debris map that was just released by the United Nations. This is a preliminary debris quantification map by the United Nations Environmental Program that shows 53.5 million tons of debris, 256,000 tons in a single tower that you can see there. The hexagonal grid is about 7.5 football fields, and they show that one tower, 56,000 tons in one area in Gaza City that is the size of the UN headquarters in New York. So mass destruction. Hebrew University just put out some numbers just actually as we were on air. 89% of buildings in Rafah have been destroyed, 84% in northern Gaza, 78% in Gaza City. And since April, when this map was released, this is the debris map as of April. But since then, since April, 2,000 buildings in Rafah per month are being destroyed by the Israeli military. They're not in this stage of Gideon's chariots fighting the resistance, as they say. They are destroying territory, as they have admitted to. This next map just came out yesterday, that Israel is a military map showing that they have created a second corridor off the Moreg corridor, which is on the left, a new corridor splicing from east to west, Khan Yunis, that you can see there. That is, again, from the settlement. That's from Kisifim, and this used to be the road into Gush Katif, the settlement that was in Gaza until 2005. So they're cutting a new corridor that's separating Khan Yunis, because you've seen on the previous maps that I've shown you on this show that Khan Yunis is spread out. And so these corridors are a way to cut the population, to cut the resistance off in these enclaves, an attempt to do that. And the red area that you see is Mawasi that I was talking about. Now we'll take a look at this first operation. This is a near capture operation that happened in Abasan al-Kabira. This is on the eastern side of Khan Yunis. Qassam said that they are targeting a Merkava tank, a Namur troop carrier, and two excavators with the Yassin 105s. You can see the driver of the excavator there. I've blurred him out to meet YouTube community standards, as we always do on this program. So there will be some parts of this video that are edited as required. But you see these fighters in their own neighborhood. They're able to track this demolition that's happening that I just reported on, 2,000 buildings a month in Rafah being destroyed. And Khan Yunis, the goal for the Israelis was the same thing, to do to Khan Yunis what they did to Rafah. So you can see the fighters here with his Yassin 105. People are familiar with this at this point. He's loading it up. They are in the destroyed ruins of a building. You can see they have multiple anti-tank warheads along with them. You can see the fighters here blurred as they move through the absolute ruination of Khan Yunis. This is now the second battle of Khan Yunis after the first battle from December 2023 until April 2024. You can see the excavators at work here. Fighter moves into position with the Yassin. And it appears that they have broken through the Israeli cordon. And we have multiple fighters. We have three excavators here destroying houses. That is their sole purpose, is to drop houses that are already mostly destroyed. Yassin strike on this excavator at the same time as the second excavator was fired on here. But you're going to see in a moment here, the soldier's going to flee the excavator. And our the footage we're seeing there is a Qassam fighter firing on him. You see him there, the Israeli soldier jumping out of the excavator and running. There he is, blurred again to meet standards. So some of this was cut out. He was then shot and killed by the resistance, who go up to him and try to decide if they're going to capture him. Here they take his weapons off him. He's actually killed with his own service weapon at the end of this, which is edited out of this report. And interestingly, the field report from Qassam that came out before said after the operation that our fighters advanced towards the enemy soldiers and engaged them with light weapons. That's the fighter standing over the soldier, and engaged them with light weapons and tried to capture one of the soldiers, but field conditions did not allow it. So they eliminated him, seized his weapons. Our fighters observed the landing of the helicopter aircraft after his evacuation. And here you see the Glock and two service M16s, their service rifles that were captured in that operation. So the field report from Qassam is exactly right. Maybe we can just run it around a second time because I have a couple more things on this. The Qassam field report before the video is exactly what we just watched on camera. Here before the video is the Israeli report. This is summarized by the Times of Israel, but it was according to the IDF probe, several Qassam gunmen emerged from a tunnel and attacked Israeli forces. During the attack, the operatives attempted to abduct the slain soldier who was operating an excavator. The IDF says that the soldier struggled with them and the terrorist shot and killed them. So you can clearly see that he did not struggle. He fled. And the reason he fled is because he's in an unarmored excavator, Volvo excavator, also on the BDS list. These Volvo excavators have been wreaking havoc across Gaza. And the story of the Israelis, they framed the story as if he was a hero. And then the Israeli media picked up that IDF probe and spun it in all their own ways, saying that he was brave and courageous and describing this situation as that their forces, Israeli forces, this is what they say in the probe, Israeli forces guarding the area opened fire on the operatives, hitting several of them and preventing the abduction attempt. So we can clearly see that that is not true. We see on this video a single incoming round that's fired at the Qassam fighters, who then at that moment decide, rather than carry out the capture of the body, that they would just return to their base safely and make that decision. It didn't come from the bravery of the soldier nor of the security of the Israeli forces in that area. Qassam put out a poster the next day talking about this soldier who you can see jumping out there from the Volvo excavator, whose sole job is to drive around and destroy houses. That's all they do. Haaretz reported last week that they get paid per house that is destroyed, her building that is destroyed. But Qassam said that this soldier right here had bad luck, and soon the next soldier's fate will be better as our new prisoner. The poster showed it and was in Hebrew for an Israeli audience, and showed the Qassam fighters in this pose here. And this is where he's loading the Israeli weapons into his pants. And that was the moment that poster had on it. This man was a West Bank settler, and his widow at his funeral talked about how he would come home every day and talk about how many buildings he destroyed in Khan Yunis in this operation. I'm going to show you this operation with audio because it's interesting here. I'm just going to point out what's going to happen here. You're going to see the fighter who has the GoPro on his head. You're going to see him look at the excavator that's dropping the building and watch the building fall. And then he turns and fires on the second excavator. So let's watch that number six now. So right at that moment, dropping the building, you can see it on the upper right there, dropping already destroyed buildings, which is what they're doing. This is the military operation. They're not trying to, they said right off the top of Gideon's Chariots that it was not about killing resistance fighters or defeating the resistance. It was about destroying territory and taking territory. And so that's what they've been doing here in the south, and particularly in Khan Yunis. But Khan Yunis, as I've been talking about for the last number of weeks, there's been more than 200 operations against Yassin strikes and IEDs against Israeli military vehicles, tanks, D9s, excavators, troop carriers. And you can see that building get dropped there. That's what they're doing, going and pushing them over. To drop them. It's cheaper than dropping bombs on them from their fighter jets, and safer, apparently, they believe, than bringing in mines, which we remember was a period of this war where they were doing it with anti-tank mines. After this one, you can see the towing of a D9 armored bulldozers. These are Caterpillar bulldozers from the United States that are armored by the Israelis, and you can see a train of them there pulling, and that's a tank being pulled. And you can see in the upper right that that's from Friday, the 4th of July, where those tanks and bulldozers were disabled. If we look at the next, it was 3 days after this that the Israeli Ministry of Defense took receipt of these D9 bulldozers from the United States, Peoria, Illinois, Caterpillar bulldozers. The Israeli Ministry of Defense said that a shipment from the United States of dozens of bulldozers for the Israeli army arrived after months of delay. These were held up by the Biden administration and immediately released by the Trump administration. They were unloaded at Haifa Port, some Menk Osint. Open source intelligence trackers noticed that the ship arriving in Haifa port had no AIS tracker on. And this, the defense ministry says, is, you can look at the next one too, is a similar picture. You can see that the Israelis do the armoring of the bulldozers after the fact that they're delivered from the U.S. And this marked, we've been tracking this all war as well. The Ministry of Defense said 870 transport planes and 144 ships have delivered more than 100,000 tons of armaments and military equipment to Israel. And that is almost exclusively from the United States, a little bit from Germany. But this is an American project that's allowing this war to continue, because the bulldozers that you saw disabled there are replaced by the Americans. And that's what you're seeing here. One more operation from Khan Yunis from this week. This is a Sarai al-Quds operation. You can see they've been using, and I've been talking about this for the last couple of weeks, you see them using innovative systems because their military manufacturing is not on the same level as the Qassam brigades, who we still see using appropriate weapons. But here we see a wounded fighter moving into position to use a 107 millimeter rocket artillery shell that we see fired all the time in an arcing trajectory. But these fighters here are using it as a direct anti-personnel weapon on a no arc, just a direct delivery from the rubble to the Israeli position. And Sral Quds also in Khan Yunis that same day talked about a near capture operation themselves, that they almost captured soldiers after an IED on a Namur troop carrier. So these are getting closer and closer, it sounds like, these capture operations, because there's also one in the north where we're going to move to now. If we look at the map of northern Gaza, as we do, thanks again to Maxwell for making these maps, but you can see the focus of the operations right now have been in Beit Hanun after the ambush that killed five soldiers and wounded at least 14 in an ambush a couple weeks back. The war on Beit Hanun, which was supposed to be destroyed, we were told several times and controlled several times before, is still ongoing right now. If we look at the next map, you can see the evacuation of eastern Gaza City and Jabalia City. And this is a massive expulsion order, ethnic cleansing order that NORA reported on at the beginning, and the United Nations said is more than 100,000 people were forced out in one day. And again, they do it with massacres at the same time as the evacuation notices to really underscore the message of the genocide for the Israelis. Taking a look at the next video, number 13, is a Sral Quds sniper operation. You can see the Israeli flag on the top of the hill in Tufa. This is just outside of the old city of Gaza City. And that flag acts as basically a windsock that helps the snipers get there. Get their coordinates and tracking of the distance. So these flags are odd, but they use them in large measure. They use them so they don't kill each other, because the Israelis just shoot to kill anything that moves. And so in these free fire zones, the Israelis have to carry big flags around so they don't shoot each other. And this next operation is Sral Quds showed up with another Melutka that we see here. It's maybe an Iranian copy of that. It's called the Raed, but it's a Melutka anti-tank wire-guided missile. It's one of the most common wire-guided anti-tank missiles in the world. And there are some of these still in Gaza that came from smuggling routes from many years ago. And are we've seen them be used a few times here. They're going to be using it against an Israeli position that you can see. This is along in the Shujaiya area. Another four soldiers were wounded today. There's been 14 Yassin and IED attacks just in this past week against tanks and APCs in Shujaiya. So these operations in Shujaiya, which also was said to be under control and destroyed, are still happening apace, it seems. And then this next operation, this is a pretty remarkable shot. This was released by the state broadcaster in Israel through the military censor. This is drone footage of a coordinated operation in Jabalia Balat, in the city of Jabalia. We'll watch it. You can see in the first strike, we'll loop it around again a second time, but you'll see there's a the first fighter launches presumably a Yassin strike that hits the first tank. There's two tanks in this video. Hits the first tank. You'll see here on the bottom, the tank on the bottom gets hit. And just as it's being hit, if you look in the top left, you can see the fighter emerging and running and hand delivering what appears to be a guerrilla action device that he throws up on top of the tank. A lot of people said it was a Shawad, but people who watch this show know that that's not a Shawad. The Shawad is way too heavy to be carried the way he's carrying it. And if we look at the next one, there's a tighter edit of it that you can see. You can watch the fighter in the upper left corner emerge from the rubble. And you can see he's running too freely for that to be a Shawad. Then he throws it up on a 10-foot high tank that's 15 feet wide. And that's not what we see with Shawad that are more than 50 pounds. But you can see it's just remarkable. And this was released by the state broadcaster, so it went through the military censor. It's not clear why Israel thinks showing these videos does anything but show the Palestinian resistance to be carrying out these operations that are that take significant courage to hand deliver weapons to a tank. I think that goes without saying. And this battle in Jabalia and this scene from Jabalia is just remarkable footage. And the fighter you see emerges from the rubble, throws the guerrilla action device, and returns to the rubble, returning to his base safely, which the Israelis admitted as well. You can see in the next shot there, this is a still frame of the first tank getting hit, a direct hit by the Yassin. And you can see in the upper left corner there, you see the fighter emerging, and you can see the way he's carrying. That's not a Shawad. He's running too freely for a Shawad. That's probably a guerrilla action device. It's not clear why he throws it on top and not insert it into the turret gap, but they make those decisions based on battlefield conditions, and it's not clear from this drone footage why that choice was made, but it's a remarkable operation. And you can see in the next screen that it's a significant weapon. The guerrilla action device is a Yassin warhead with a magnetic affixer on it. And so they're a devastating weapon as well that we have seen be used all over Gaza. And there was some talk in the Israeli media, their military correspondents and the military talking to their correspondents, saying that the Palestinian resistance is getting more bold, is more bold right now than previous times. But again, people who watch this show, we've seen guerrilla action devices hand delivered, Shawad is hand delivered. We've seen tanks and troop carriers attempted to be mounted by soldiers. So these don't seem to be any more bold than we've seen throughout the war. And there was a video released about a week and a half ago that was from December. This is also in Jabalia. This is in Jabalia camp. This is during number 19 is during the general's plan in December of last year, with the attempt to ethnically cleanse all of northern Gaza, which was promised by the Israeli military from October to January, the ceasefire, and didn't happen because of the resistance in the camp. So number 19 is going to start with audio here, so I'll stop. So I left that in there so you could hear the Yassin strike there. You saw the Shawad. Again, you see the Shawad. They have to carry it with two hands. He passes it with two hands to the fighter. But then this is captured drone footage of the Israelis that Qassam acquired by downing one of their drones. And you can see from the Israeli footage of the medevac into Jabalia camp to extract their soldiers, which is something that we haven't really seen this footage, this type of footage of it. It's a pretty remarkable angle of it. And this operation took place in late December, December 23rd, to be exact, according to Qassam. And we're going to see at the end the Qassam fighters return to their base safely. But again, you're seeing the medevac there. Those are Namur troop carriers that you're seeing there. And the soldiers are being carried out, shown from Israeli drone footage. So two videos of Israeli drone footage that are pretty remarkable. Interesting angle that we don't see all the time of these operations. And then on the other side of the operations of the medevacs, you can see them loading into the back here of the Namur troop carrier. Which is one of the functions of the troop carrier, is that you're able to load the gurneys into the back of the armored vehicle. So remarkable operation in Jabalia. And I just wanted to say that this week, just closing out, that Abu Ubaidah acknowledged and Qassam acknowledged, there's the fighters returning to their base safely at the end of that operation. Abu Ubaidah spoke about Muhammad al-Daif's anniversary of his assassination. So this is really actually the first time they have acknowledged the date of July 13, when we know that he, the commander of the Qassam Brigades, was killed. And Abu Ubaida said, a year has passed since the departure of the great martyr of the nation, Commander Muhammad al-Daif, who with his brothers led Al-Aqsa flood, delivering the harshest blow in its history to the Zionist enemy, which led to the permanent collapse of Zionist deterrence, the unification of the nation's energies, and the redirection of its compass towards Palestine, and the return of the Palestinian cause to the forefront once again. For decades, Muhammad al-Daif remained an inspiration for generations who did not know his image, but were proud of the actions of his victorious brigades, and he will remain, like other leaders, a beacon for free people of the world. So that's just something I wanted to notice, take note of, Abu Ubaida acknowledging Muhammad al-Daif's assassination a year ago, July 13th. So that is the Resistance Report for this week, day 650 of this war.
Thank you, as always, John. So much. That comment you made about the way that the fighters are using how the wind is flapping the enormous Israeli flags on these berms, is I don't know, that just really stuck out to me.
Well, when you're calibrating your sniper shot, the bullet travels for such a distance that you have to calibrate the wind into your targeting, and so to have a massive flag right there is just like, self-defeating.
Yeah. Israelis love their flags. They put them on everything. They put massive amounts of them on everything. And
They do it. Part of it is definitely psychological operation. But a lot of it is just survival for them, because, like I said, and like we know, they shoot and kill anyone that they see moving. Yeah. And so they have to roll around like that. And it allows, especially on a hill like that in Tufa, right? The hills along eastern Gaza City, the Israelis try to take up those positions. Those are historic positions that are the gateway into Gaza City that have been fought for thousands of years. And those hills are used strategically by the Israelis. But when they're up there with a flag, the resistance can see where they are. And those positions were hit. There was three sniper, seriously wounded sniper operations just in that area alone this week.
And what can you say, just very quickly, what can you say about there are rumors now that, and we'll get into this in a minute, but, you know, now that Israel is just bombing, many different places in the region, but this week they bombed Syria, and then the Israeli army said that it's going to redeploy troops, pull them out of Gaza and put them into Syria. What can you say about the number of Israeli battalions in Gaza, the kinds of battalions that we're seeing, and the, overall losses that they're sustaining?
Well, yeah, they have shortages. So when the Iran war started, they had to pull troops out of Gaza. If they're looking to secure the border of their occupied Golan Heights, then they need soldiers from there, and they don't have enough of them. And they have a vacancy that's more than 10,000 killed and wounded. That number goes back to last year. So they have been not updating their wounded numbers at all. But also the people haven't come back from being called back to reserve duty. And that those numbers are significant too. But again, they don't report on all those numbers. So everything is covered by a military sensor that doesn't let you know the exact details. But you can see the clues to it by when they need to reinforce a position, they need to pull troops out of Gaza to do it. They don't have enough troops to do both. Whereas at the beginning of this war, they did. They had enough troops to go up to the Lebanon border and also send five divisions into Gaza, and they can't do that now. And that I read those quotes from the highest leadership talking about how they don't have enough soldiers. They're going to leave their tanks orphaned because they don't have enough soldiers to replace them. Well, and that would be the same about their gear too, if the Americans didn't constantly deliver new gear.
Right. There was something like the, I don't know, there was a new shipment of D9 Caterpillar bulldozers just in the last week, and I forget the exact number, but it's some like astounding number. And it's like, I think every 15 hours, there's a weapons shipment from the US, something crazy like that. That's the average.
And if those bulldozers didn't arrive, they could not continue to do the destruction that they're doing.
Incredible. Incredible. All right.
And I think it's important to note, we mentioned last week, Francesca Albanese's new report with the corporations that are complicit in this genocide. One of them is Hyundai, which makes, and Caterpillar, of course, both of which make equipment that is used in those demolitions that John showed us. And Volvo is another. I'm off the top of my head, I can't recall if Volvo is or is not included in her report. We'll have to check that. But it's certainly been a target of campaigners for many years. So again, when you're watching these videos from Gaza of the demolition of the of homes just for the sake of destruction, remember this is connected to our societies. These are corporations that are all around us, and that's why activists around the world are putting pressure on them and on the governments that support them and authorize their exports to stop.
You know, and the, I mean, you can, you know, a very clear indication of the efficacy of just one country. I mean, you know, Yemen enforcing their humanitarian intervention in the Red Sea has effectively bankrupted the entire Eilat port. I mean, just this week, Israel had to admit that they're basically locking the gates and you know, storing the keys for the entire port of Eilat. It is completely bankrupt. The Israeli government even promised something like 15 million shekels to keep it afloat, and the Israeli government never did. And that is entirely because of the ongoing blockade in the Red Sea that Israel, you know, is having enforced against it because of its ongoing genocide.
Yeah, the Eilat port has been virtually shut down since November 2023.
And I just looked at Francesca Albanese's report. Just a reminder, it is From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide, published just very recently by the Special Rapporteur on UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. And it does include Volvo. So Volvo, Hyundai and Caterpillar are on that list of companies profiting from genocide because they supply the equipment that is used to destroy Gaza's homes, infrastructure, hospitals, just for the sake of destruction.
And they can't, they don't even have soldiers doing all, they have contractors doing in Rafah where they have total control. They
which goes to show the dual use nature of many of these exports to Israel, which is why it's not enough. Of course, there needs to be an arms embargo, but these are dual use items. These Hyundai diggers and this equipment.
The
Caterpillar D9s are military sales, and then they arrive in Israel, and then Israel armors them, but they're sold as military sales, whereas the Hyundai and Volvo equipment is sold to private contractors who are then using it to carry out demolitions. This has been the case for decades in occupied East Jerusalem and across the West Bank, and now they've brought those contractors into Gaza as well.
Yeah, so Haaretz reported in Hebrew last week that the military is offering to pay bulldozer and excavator operators 2,500 shekels to raise a building of three stories and 5,000 shekels for taller structures.
Yeah. And that's cheaper than, you know, for them, that's still a better deal, if we put it in these very crude terms, than dropping, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 American GBU bomb. So... But these contractors who go in are mercenaries. They are engaging in a, they are participating in a genocide, which is why presumably the resistance would view them as legitimate targets. They're there as part of a military that is engaging in a genocide. They're not, they've lost their civilian status. I'm assuming that's how they would see it.
Yeah, that's in Rafah. So they have the contractors in that, in Khan Yunis, in that video that I showed, that was a soldier. That's soldiers, and that's an Israeli military unit that's doing that destruction.
All right. Well, let's talk about the attacks on Syria by Israel yesterday. I think it was yesterday. Israel, leveled buildings in downtown Damascus.
Well, there was. There are constant Israeli attacks. I mean, constant, a lot of it doesn't get reported, as is the case in Lebanon. But the sort of spectacular visuals and scale of the attack in downtown Damascus on government buildings, including the buildings belonging to the defense ministry and close to the presidential palace. And there's actually footage of those strikes that we can look at. And this was in downtown Damascus yesterday. I don't know if... Yeah, here we go. Yeah, so a shock and awe attack on downtown Damascus, which was actually on live television. I saw other footage, I'm not sure if it was I think it may have been a Syrian channel, I'm not certain, where the anchor, the woman actually, jumps out of her seat because of the proximity of the bombing, which you see behind her. I'm not sure if it's on a screen or on a window that's behind her. And that's actually very reminiscent of the footage we saw from Iran a couple of weeks ago of that newsreader continuing to read when Israel bombed the studio there. And, without getting into a great amount of detail, this comes as Israel also intervened in southern Syria in fighting between people in the Druze community in southern Syria and forces belonging to the U.S.-backed regime in Damascus, U.S. and Gulf and Turkish-backed regime in Damascus. And to me, this really shows that being a proxy of Turkey, the Gulf, of the United States, even of Israel, remember this regime that was installed with support of Western intelligence services after a 15-year dirty war against Syria, has been extremely friendly towards Israel from the beginning, saying we don't want Syria to be used as a platform against Israel. We don't have a problem with Israel. They've been making friendly noises. Gideon Saar, the Israeli foreign minister, even said a few days ago that he was looking forward to being at a meeting with the new Syrian foreign minister in Brussels in coming days. I'm not sure what happened with that. And there's some other context here, which is that just a few days ago, U.S. envoy Tom Barak recently warned Lebanon that if it didn't move to arm Hezbollah, the resistance group, then, who knows, then Syria might move in and annex Lebanon and create greater Syria once again, Bilad al-Sham. And those comments were taken very, very badly in Lebanon, as you can imagine. And they were really taken as a sign that the U.S. sees this Al-Qaeda-linked, ISIS-linked regime in Damascus as a proxy to do its bidding. And in this case, threatening to use it to discipline Lebanon. So the message, the message Israel is sending with its attacks on Damascus is that is really the opposite message, that if you disarm, no matter how servile you are towards Israel, Israel will attack you. Israel will do what it wants. And you can get exactly the same picture in the West Bank, where you know, I'll admit we don't talk about it enough because everything is sort of dwarfed by what's happening in Gaza. But the levels of Israeli violence against people in the West Bank, we have reported on it, you know, of course. Tens of thousands of people displaced, the destruction, the wholesale destruction of refugee camps, Jenin, the destroying Tul Karim refugee camp. Now they're moving around the West Bank, destroying these places. All this is happening under the watch of the Palestinian Authority of Mahmoud Abbas, which is completely allied with Israel, which couldn't exist without Israel's support. So again, it's a message to what I think resistance groups in the region will take, particularly Hezbollah and Ansar Allah in Yemen, is that if you disarm, if you give up your weapons, they'll kill you and bomb you and subjugate you anyway. So yeah, you might as well resist. And I don't know, I'm being speculative here. Maybe that's what Israel wants, because if the region remains in chaos, if it remains a constant site of warfare and resistance to its aggression, that keeps the United States in the region, which the US, Israel is completely dependent on US military support and on the proximity of US military forces and fleets. And so after the Turkish US Gulf-backed regime change operation finally came to fruition in Damascus in December, and then we saw Israel bomb every Syrian army installation, bomb the Navy, bomb the Air Force, bomb the assets of the Syrian state, which remained. Bashar al-Assad was gone, but these were assets of the Syrian state and the Syrian people, and Israel totally destroyed them, even though the new regime in Damascus was saying, you know, we want to be your friends. And so now Syria is totally vulnerable, and Israel has declared that no Syrian government forces are allowed to move south of Damascus, that basically all of Syria south of Damascus, and this is a vast stretch of territory, is now an Israeli security zone, and Israel alone gets to decide what is there. So, you know, we were told that this the change of government in Syria was going to bring about Syrian sovereignty, that Syrian sovereignty was being violated by Iran, was being violated by Hezbollah, that as soon as Bashar al-Assad was gone, there would be a Syrian renaissance of independence and sovereignty and self-determination and democracy. And we see actually what the reality is, that Syria basically doesn't exist as a state anymore. It certainly exists as an idea, as a nation, as a place on the map, but as a functioning state, it has ceased to exist. It has no sovereignty. And this would be the fate of Lebanon. You can imagine that if Hezbollah, if the resistance in Lebanon didn't exist, Israel would not only say, the Lebanese army is not allowed south of Beirut, for example, just as Israel is saying no Syrian forces allowed south of Damascus, its capital. But you might have Lebanon occupied up to and beyond Beirut, because what would stop it? So that's, I just wanted to give that bigger context, that the regime change in Syria has led to this. It certainly hasn't led to democracy and human rights for people in Syria as people advertised. And to say this is also what Israel tried to do to Iran with the June 13th surprise attack. It was a shock and awe attack with the aim of collapsing the Iranian state so that Iran would be in chaos, so that there would be internecine wars like there are now in Syria, which Israel is exploiting by pitting the Druze against the new regime and or exploiting differences that already exist, playing on them. And that's their vision for Iran as well. It was the vision for Iraq, which was implemented by the Americans. And it's what they would do, certainly their vision for Lebanon, and it's what they would do to any country around them to maintain the chaos that without which Israel would collapse. So that's the context I see for the events in Syria.
Well, we're certainly going to keep watching it. It's astonishing to see, it is textbook. It's textbook imperial, hegemonic warfare. It feels like we're reliving, something from 20 years ago where they were
from 100 years ago. This is gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, also look at this. It's like, where are these sort of great, powerful states? This new regime in Syria, whatever you think of it, it has the backing of Turkey with its NATO air force and its NATO military. It has the backing of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, of all of these very wealthy states. None of them none of them are really defending it. We haven't seen Turkey say, how dare you bomb Damascus, the capital, the heart of the capital of a state with which Turkey has a friendly and supportive relationship. And if you bomb Damascus, we'll bomb Tel Aviv. Where's Turkey to say that? So it's just remarkable the levels of impunity that Israel has, and what it's allowed to get away with is extraordinary.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ali. Let's take a look at the website. We've published so much in the last week. We had two features from Assam, who was on the program earlier today.
His writing is so extraordinary. Heard how he speaks. He speaks like a poet. He's an engineer and a poet. Yeah. And speaking about such heavy topics. And he writes so beautifully. He mentioned that Dr. Rifat al-Arayr, the late Dr. Rifat, of course, people who regular viewers know that Asim was a childhood friend of Rifat and his student, and Rifat continues to be an inspiration. You can see that
they sound similar. That's the thing that you pointed out a while ago, it really is so true. They have the same cadence and the same gentleness and like a little bit of mischief even in the back of their voice. Rifat really does live through so many people in Gaza, and Assam is one of those. And he's just so lovely. So there's that
There's a great piece from Michael Brown on Trump and Netanyahu dither on Gaza ceasefire, and that gets into some of the politics around this in the US, which is a beat that Michael covers so well.
Yeah, I know. It's a great sacrifice that Michael makes watching hours of mainstream corporate media.
Yeah, so that I can't stomach it, but... I had to read the rape hoax report, so I did my penance.
We all have Michael, our burdens to bear.
Yeah, Michael does his by monitoring U.S. politicians and U.S. media very closely.
Yeah. So thank you, Michael. Asa's new piece about Palestine solidarity organizations in London and some behind-the-scenes investigation there. PSC secretly dropped Loki as a patron. And we have so much more. There are things that we just published in the last 24 hours. Of course, Palestine in Pictures, we talked about last week from our colleague Maureen.
And if you haven't looked at it and shared it, please do. These are incredibly powerful and timeless images. And there's really, a lot of really powerful reporting. And by the way, something I want to mention, a regular feature that we do every week, but we don't always mention on the show. Let's look at that. Let's look at Ellie Gerzon's piece about last week's live stream. So pretty much every week, we do, we try to do it as quickly as we can. Sometimes it takes a couple of days. Kind of a roundup of that week's live stream with some of the key points, some of the highlights, and often updates on some of the stories that we have talked about in this week's show. So we'll be doing this for the show you're watching now, and that will be up on the website. And Ellie goes on, often writes them. Sometimes I do, sometimes other people do. But that's also a great way, if you missed the show, to come and find and get kind of a quick summary and figure out what you might want to watch. And it's a great way to share it. So I just wanted to point that out too. It's a regular feature that we want to give some love to. Exactly. And we're very grateful to Ellie for doing that, as well as a lot of the social media clips that go out from these discussions.
Absolutely. And if you haven't already, hit the Donate Now button, either on the top of the Electronic Intifada website or on YouTube, or wherever you're watching this. We depend on your support to keep this platform running, and keep paying our writers who are risking their lives to document their own genocide in Gaza. And Ali, I know that you have some people this week who you'd like to thank for their sustained support.
I want to thank everyone, each and every person who supports us in every way, by making donations, by sending notes that are just so loving and encouraging. And in fact, I have a couple here. I want to show one. This is actually from a regular live stream viewer. We heard David Cronin tell us that Katharina von Schnürbein, the EU's so-called anti-Semitism czar, is trying to ban the phrase "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Well, Simone sent it to us on a postcard. You see there, it says, "From the river to the sea, from the rind to the seed." And then on the back, it says, "Palestine will be free." And it's a beautiful handmade, I think it's a watercolor, and I just love it. So thank you for that, Simone. We have a lovely note from Evelyn. She says, this is a handwritten note. She says, "Greetings, EI. Your work continues to be my blessing in all things Gaza. I'm forever grateful for all I've learned about Palestine and the Palestinian people via EI. Thank you for your steadfast ways in my prayers daily." That was just such a touching note. Mm. And all the emails mean so much to us. I want to thank some regular, long-time supporters. Nothing is regular. You're all extraordinary supporters. That we don't have regular supporters. Everyone is an extraordinary supporter. Daniel, Elizabeth, and Doug, as well as Nasser, Peter, Rima, Lisa, Hassan, and Amin, and some new friends, people who've made the decision to give us some support recently, and we appreciate each and every one of you. Zandile, Mariana, Kieran, Ron, Lila, Maria, and Stephanie. That's just a few names, just to say that we're grateful to each and every person. You make this work possible.
Yes, thank you indeed. So yes, again, if you are so moved and are able to go to our Donate Now link at the top of the electronicintifada.net website or through this YouTube in the description, and thank you so much for that. So I want to also thank Tamara Nassar, of course, for producing and directing this program, to Ellie Gerzon for social media production and those excellent write-ups that they do, and everyone at the Electronic Intifada, Maureen Claire Murphy, Michael F. Brown, and on behalf of myself and John, Ali, Tamara, Ellie, thank you all, and we will see you next week.